The Landsat project that you'd
Well, what on. I what I did was when we happened to be when the first Landsat came back that we started getting, we got on, it was in March of 1973, and the first one, oh, here, it's in this thing here. Oops, the paper is in here. You can get one of these books. I don't know if you might
it's
even
probably
have
in the library.
You can get one for free. Go to the map office down there.
So it's called Climate of the Arctic.
Yeah, they've got hundreds of them laying around down there. Let me see. Let's see if I can remember. I can find it off. Yeah. Ah, here we go. This is paper. This was the first one.
Okay.
That's the name of it.
Satellite observations of sea ice movement in the Bering Strait region.
Yeah. Okay. So all we did was we got these pictures came down. These were Landsat. Now, there were 3 days of pictures. Here's this. This is the map of the pictures that we worked with. And we made a mosaic, or they made a mosaic downstairs here in the photo lab. And so these are two consecutive days. I don't know if we got the third day in here. But anyway, we had mosaics for 3 days. Mm-hmm. And this shows it. So they overlap. So you could look at one picture, and then you could compare the next one, and you can identify points on the pack ice from this picture that are still here on this
right.
one. Okay.
As reference.
Okay, so in order to map it, what you can do is you can come up with these little vectors, see, if you compare them from, okay, so the way I did this thing was we had the picture, the individual pictures. I didn't have the mosaics at the time. I had the individual pictures, and I took a big sheet of Mylar, okay, and I rolled it out on my kitchen table at home. And then I started marked the positions, the corners of all of these pictures on the Mylar, and then I went through, and by moving, take a picture out, put another one in, I could trace where these things went.
So where those ice features moved.
Yeah, and so this is what these things show. Mm-hmm. This is the movement that we got. And then this is a map of the ice broken. And what was interesting about it was, to me, since I was, just from my background in mechanics, it suggested to me that the ice was behaving as well, you know, that it was basically going through what this is called an extrusion process. This is a process of pushing, let's say, a molten slab, a billet, called, through a die to make a form. Okay, and there's ways of calculating what the flow pattern should be, and so on. And what this suggests is that these sort of lead patterns that you see, which is what this picture is, and this one here, is akin to the idea that when the ice is being pushed out through Bering Strait, it's behaving in a way that's similar to this sort of process.
This extrusion process.
Extrusion process, yeah. And the process can be modeled either with what's called a perfectly plastic material, which is an engineering term or a mechanics term that you don't have to get involved in, or it could even be an aggregate. I mean, the same sort of analysis applies to things like soils, boundaries like this are what are called shear boundaries. Bottom of a landslide is a shear boundary. Mm-hmm. The soil above it flows away. If you're moving grain in a silo or in a chute or something in a grain elevator, the same sort of analysis applies. Or moving in chutes underground in a mine, the same sort of analysis.
So why this work with the sea ice in Bering Strait, why was that important?
Just because it gave you a way of thinking about it, okay? And it turns out when the Ajax people were writing their models, it turns out they liked perfectly plastic materials. And then they did an analysis, the same thing, using plastic materials from here to come up with these kinds of patterns. They did the engineering analysis, and before that, a guy named Dove Sody at Krell had done one, only he treated it like an aggregate, like a loose material, see? And so when the guys did the plastic stuff, they showed, well, that theory, the aggregate thing is a special case of that. You know, so you're getting into all kinds of mathematical stuff. But basically the idea is that the thing behaves like an aggregate or a perfectly plastic material. You use the same sort of analyses to handle both types of materials in these situations. So it gives you a way of thinking about ice. What kind of a mechanical law you might use to talk about modeling ice.
Oh, okay.
But that's, you know, and that applies to a special situation, because the whole art of picking the laws of mechanics depends on really understanding what the problem is you're trying to solve.
Hmm.
Because, you know, it gets back to this thing about, we talked about earlier, about the silly putty.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very different material depending on the conditions that you deal with it.
So this is very specific to the Bering Straits.
It works. It'll work any place. It works for the whole area, actually. Mm-hmm. You can think about it that way. You can think that if you think in terms of these models, you're going to have, in any time when the ice is moving, something jams at some place, you're going to have a dead space in here, and the ice is going to be shearing off past it, going the other direction. It's a little more complicated than that. But basically, I mean, the whole art of doing these sorts of analyses for any material. I mean, if you're going to build a building, and you're working with steel, you know the range of properties of steel that you're going to deal with in a building. Okay,
right.
Take it up to 800 degrees C, or 800 Fahrenheit or something. You got a different material.
Right.
See? So that's the idea here. And so you kind of, you know, you if you want to do a long-term, very long-term averaging of this stuff, you might talk about it as a viscoelastic material, not even plastic, something totally different. It just, you pick the law that works for the material over the range that you're trying to deal with it.
Uh-huh.
Okay, there's no universal law that applies to sea ice, period, or even a small piece of sea ice.
Right, interesting.
That's why any material is like that, but we're not used to it because we deal with things that, you know, in a limited range of temperatures.
Right.
You know, and as long as you stay within that range, we're good. See?
So what made you think to use Landsat imagery?
Because that was what was there. First ones came down, I looked at that, and I said, my gosh, you know, and I was looking at this thing here and starting to talk about it, and Burns walked in, we were downstairs one day, and John, I knew him at the time, who he was. But
so marine mammal biologist.
Yeah. He walked in, he was interested in that too, because he was trying to get these satellites and do these things, you know, and so we said, well, let's take a look at this. So we sort of started talking about it together, and that's where this paper came from.
Mm-hmm.
And then eventually I got involved with him and Bud Fay,
mm-hmm.
and who unfortunately died a number of years ago, too early.
Mm-hmm.
He was John's advisor. He was a marine mammal biologist also.
And then what were you guys doing together?
We did this long OCSEP report on the relationship between sea ice and marine mammals, which is somewhere around here. It's a big OCSEP report. And we finished that about 1980, I think. There were a couple of small papers on it, but it was a big report, and people still surprised me to still talk about it.
Well,
it should have been a book.
Those marine mammals rely on that sea ice. It's a very symbiotic relationship.
Yeah, so we did. Now, basically, what we did was we took all the information that we could get at that time on distribution of marine mammals, what had been done. A lot of it was, you know, Burns and Fay.
Right.
And stuff that had been done in Bering Sea. Nobody was doing much in the Beaufort except for flying out, looking for seals and so on. And then we looked at all the satellite stuff and made some maps of ice types and different, you know, and so on at different times of year, and put the mammals on it and basically wrote something that said, this is where the critters are.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where they are at certain times of year. It's interesting, Bud Fay was doing these, looking at satellite pictures, and Bud picked out these areas in Bering Sea where ice tends to stay around for a long period of time in the spring. And Burns knew about it. He kind of speculated about that because there had to be someplace they went to get out, to haul out. I didn't know where they were. And it turns out they haul out on ice that sits out in the middle of Bering Sea and stays around for a very long time. And so that came out of that, and Bud was able to nail that down and show that you could tell early in the year where the remnants were going to be and how big they were going to be. That's in that thing, too. And then we talked to the Navy about that one time, and that was really of interest to them because you can hide a submarine under that stuff very easily.
So,
because you can't do sonar. The sonar doesn't work well because of the differences in water temperature structure.
Hmm.
So they, we talked to one guy who was doing that kind of thing. Wow, I have to go back and look at that and never hear any more about it, of course.
Right.
But he was interested in it. He was a guy who was working for the Navy Undersea Lab at the time. Hmm. And John knew him because, they were interested in ice around this area.
John was out in Nome at the time, probably.
No, he was back here.
He was back here.
So we collaborated on that. That was a lot of fun to do. We did that for a long time.
Yeah,
worked cool. on that. So, but that's where that came about. So it was the first, they were just the first pictures that we got. And you ever hear of Katie's Floberg? You mm-hmm. must know that name. That's a big massive ice off Gnarl out here that sets up every year. That was turned up in the first, on top of one of those pictures.
Say it again, what is it?
Katie's Floberg.
Stringer.
Katie March. She was the woman that was running the lab at the data center at that time.
Katie's Floberg off Gnarl.
Yeah, Bill Stringer wrote something about it.
Okay.
But it was on the same sequence of pictures up here. But we just picked off these and worked with those.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of Gnarl, so you started going up to Barrow to do research when?
It was 1974.
So was Gnarl still in operation?
Oh, yeah, sure. It was operated. It operated until 80, 81.
Oh, yeah, and UIC took it over, I think, in 80. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Max Brewer was no longer in charge.
No, Max was gone. Yeah, and Schindler was gone, I think.
So was Brian Shoemaker the guy in charge?
I don't know who the first one was.
When you were there?
And then Warren Denner was the guy that was there most of the time that I was there. And then I dropped out. I was up there pretty steady from 74 till 81, I think. And then I went back again in about 88 after UIC had it and was there, worked there. I'm not sure. I don't remember when the last one was. Probably late.
You said before mid-90s maybe?
Late
96, 97?
96, 97, 98, somewhere in there.
Okay.
We were breaking ice. There was a documentary done on Richard Glenn. I don't know if you did it.
No, I don't.
Yeah, he was. It was on Richard. It was done by PBS. By the station from Boston.
WGBH.
Whatever it was.
Yeah, that's the Boston one.
Yeah, they did one, and it was on. They were talking about three different scientists. One guy was like an African American guy who was doing. String theory, and then Richard working on sea ice, and I forget who the third guy was, and that he was doing something. But they were interested in, in members of minority groups who were pushing along in science. And at that time, Richard was working on a PhD with us.
Right.
And so we were up there. We were splitting ice, breaking ice, working with another group. It was a combination of me from here, people from here, me and somebody from Crell and somebody from Clarkson University. But anyway, we had these ice, ice fracture experiments going on. And I was working, I was doing that.
And that was the 80s and 90s, right?
Yeah, well, early 90s, it's up to some point. I don't remember the date.
So 74 to 81.
That was OCSEP.
And that's when you had your Wannigan out on the ice?
Yeah, that's when we,
Same thing, you were doing structural.
And then the stuff with the radar was just kind of a sideline to that. Because it was there and we were there, so we could just look at it. And if something happened, we maybe could go out and see what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But it was sort of in the background.
It's sort of the precursor to Hayo's video camera that he has mounted that you can
see. Yeah, we actually had one up there for a little while. It was a little 8mm.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, the pictures are actually, we picked up some really interesting stuff on it. But. We had it just for a little while. We had a little 8mm camera that would take a picture every couple of minutes or something, take one frame.
So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you mentioned working with Kenny Tuvok on that interviewing project, but you're working with the Inupiaq people in Barrow and...
Well, Kenny was, ran a shop, one of the shops, I guess, at Gnarl when the Navy had it.
Mm-hmm.
So he kind of went out of the game, at that point. And then when I went away, when I came back, I always knew him, so I used to see him a lot.
Well, when you went up in 74,
he was busy then. He was running things. But I used to, I'd see him off and on, even after I was working back up there again later. But, and that was really more when I shouldn't say that was more, I knew him both times, but I always talked to him a lot. and ask him questions. He was always very coming, or very open with answers and so on. So I learned a lot about how to look at things, how to look at up there, things to look for. He was just, you know, I just got along very well with him. I liked him.
Yeah.
And I could always go to him with questions. And it was just fun to just sit down and talk to him about ICE. But I didn't have much contact with other people because when I have my wife and kids who were small kids here. And so when I had to go up there, I went and I did my work and got back out. Mm-hmm. And so I never did stay around there that much. Ron Metzen knew a lot of the people up there.
So your field work, you were there for a few days or
couple of weeks or something like that. Mm-hmm. But I don't think I was ever up there for more than about 10 days mm-hmm. or so.
Well, I didn't know if you ever had a local person go with you and do your help with your experiments and your lab work.
No.
It was just you guys out on the ice.
Yeah. And then, later on, somebody would haul me around on a snow machine or something like that, and I worked with Richard, Glenn. But for the most part, I knew my way around up there well enough that I could do things. In fact, there was a time there after UIC took over when, I had keys to half of the buildings up there because I was doing, I had things going on all over the place, and it was easier for them to just, Shapiro's keys, I just go up and get them, and I could get into these various buildings. We had a truck parked in one place with this big saw on it, just all sorts of things.
Well, people knew you. You'd been going
and I was pretty well trusted, and so I didn't have stole anything or anything. Took care of stuff.
But then they
took over and gradually things changed, which is what you'd expect.
Right. Well, I was wondering if you felt like you learned things about the ice from the local people.
Well, I did from Kenny for sure. Mm-hmm. But as I say, I never had that much interaction with people other than that. But that was just the nature. I mean, first of all, there wasn't much they could help me with in terms of, busting ice. Mm-hmm. It's just not something that they were concerned about. They knew it was strong, but they knew the ice. But they couldn't put numbers on it, basically. One of the first assistants we had up there was a guy by the name of Tom Hanley, who was a Jesuit priest. He had a PhD in ice physics. And he was a friend of Tom Osterkamp's. He had a PhD from St. Louis University, I think. And so once he finished his PhD, he worked up there for us for a year. First year we were up there, that winter 73, 74. Mm-hmm. He was up there and looking around and trying to do things. But he told me once that I remember talking to him and saying that people are like, what are you trying to do? Locals. And he finally said that the best answer he'd come up with, he said, we're trying to put numbers on the things that you already know. Mm-hmm. See? And so they intuitively know things from experience. And basically, if you're an engineer, you need a number. So essentially that was it. It was just basically trying to translate the world into numbers that, into things that people who had through OCSEP anyway, people mm-hmm. who had a need for that information could understand and use. Mm-hmm. And that's basically what it's about.
Yeah. And it sounds like the local people didn't particularly pay attention to your experiments because it wasn't so meaningful to them?
Well, I don't know. I mean, people would come by occasionally and stop them. What are you doing? Let me show them. But it's not their sort of thing. Mm-hmm. It didn't relate to what they needed to know. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were interested that we were knowing, that we were trying to find these things out, but it was not something that they could use. Mm-hmm. It doesn't help them to know what Young's modulus is of ice at a certain, over a certain range or something like that. That sort of information just isn't useful to them.
Right. But they certainly know about the ice dynamics and moving and coming and going.
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, that's much more of interest to them. Mm-hmm. Sure. Oh. And that's where just general features of the ice cover. I mean, there were things that they couldn't find out, okay? For example, they couldn't know. They knew there was ice in the barrier islands. know, that there's ice in the barrier. But a lot of that, I think, was freshwater ice.
Oh, really?
It's frozen rainwater. Some of it is, anyway, at the top. But I don't think they could know that very well. Anyway, we found places. We did a little bit of seismic work up there in 74. And it looked like that's what we had, was like a lens of ice near the surface. And then when you got down below, it was frozen anymore.
So it was freshwater ice on the surface?
Might have been. Yeah, I don't remember. But I mean, that's all sort of vague. That was a project that Rogers was doing, that Jim Rogers was doing, and a couple of other people, and we went up there to help him do the seismic
and
stuff.
And that was along the barrier islands?
Yeah, on some of the barrier islands. They were interested. They were drilling out there at the time. There was some, Sea Grant was funding some work. In fact, I think the rig that the guy, Bob Llewellyn, this guy was doing it, he was drilling out there, and I think the rig, or at least the structure for the rig, is still sitting up there on the road. If you go going out towards, go up past Spinard and go up on the road, and there's a thing up there, the old rig, the building, I think, is still sitting there. At least it was the last time I was up there. I haven't been there.
Out on the old runway out there.
Yeah, right along the beach. If you go up along the beach road.
Yeah, but not on the beach side.
No, it's not on the beach side, it's just on the other side, yeah. But anyway, they were interested in that. So, again, just for the ideas, you know, people knew that it was permafrost, it had to be permafrost, and so they were looking for it. And I don't know. I mean, it's just been a long time since I...
Yeah. Also, as I told you before, I'm sort of interested in Narl as a place and what it was like working there and the atmosphere there.
Narl was a good place to work. It always was. I mean, when I was there... it was easy to work. I mean, you know, if you had a Navy-approved project, you just went in and did your work. The stuff was there. You could pretty much get what you needed. I understand. I mean, I never had any. By the time I got there, the management had changed, and whatever equipment they had, they were pretty generous with it. Mm-hmm. And then also with OCCEP, I mean, OCCEP had logistics money up there. So if I wanted, first thing I always did when I got up there, every month or so or whenever I got there, I would ask to go up for a flight, just to go out and see, just around the air, just so I could see what things look like. And so you could always get those sorts of things. There were no snow machines, though. Couldn't get a snow machine, didn't have snow machines. But, we did a lot of walking.
There were no, because there weren't any, people weren't using them yet? Well, or they just didn't have any?
Narl didn't have any on there at that time. They may have had some, but I never could get them. but a lot of it I didn't need to. I mean, there were times I'd go up there and I'd never get any further offshore than 300 feet just to get out to our shack, to our shack. So.
And you wouldn't go into town at all?
Very seldom. Very seldom. I just didn't need to. I mean, I wasn't up there long. People were going to be there for a while. They wanted to go into Pepe's or something like that, you know. But I did that a few times. But for the most part, I really wasn't interested in doing that. I mean, I just wanted to get in, do my work, and get back here.
Yeah. Well, and as you say, you weren't there for long periods of time at once, but you were there repeatedly over many years.
So you have a perspective that way. I would spend anywhere from mid-January to mid-May, I might spend anywhere from, 40, 50, 60 days up there.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Even though
it's not consecutively.
Yeah, I was up there a lot, though. It just depended on what we were doing and how things were going.
And so at Narl... Was at that time, did they still have, the cafeteria and everybody came and ate there?
Yeah, they were still using the Quonsets.
Yeah,
they were still in the Quonsets. The mess hall was still the Quonsets.
And did the scientists and the staff and the local staff all interact together?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was the most interesting place to go because to be working on ice there was really something, because it would turn out that... whoever you were sitting next to was interested in ice. Didn't make any difference what they were. I mean, the guy doing polar bears, or the guy doing birds, the guy doing amphipods under the ice or something like that, they all had interest in sea ice. And so there was lots of interesting conversation. It was a very interesting place. At certain times of year when there were active projects there were always interesting people going through.
Yeah, in January you may have been the only ones there.
That was at the start, but as you go through the season, things would build up, and people would come up to do things, and they needed daylight or something.
Right. But I've always wondered. I don't know how it was at Narl, if the scientists and the local people ate together and chatted together.
Well, everybody who was working at Narl and could use the mess hall, was in there at one time or another. So you'd wind up talking to just about anybody.
Okay.
Couldn't tell. I mean, you know, there are little cliques, you know, you go in with your friends and so on. But, you know, you'd sit down at a table and start eating, and somebody that you didn't know would come up, and pretty much you'd be in conversation, and mm-hmm. whatever they were interested in, it would be what you'd be talking about. So it was kind of an interesting community. And it was also kind of isolated in the sense, you mm-hmm. know, the staff that were up there all the time had their own games, their own things to do.
Right.
And so on. So, they, you know, there was that difference, if you will.
Like the Navy's, I don't, you know.
Well, there was only one Navy guy up there. There was only one Navy guy up there.
By that time, yeah.
Yeah, he was a naval commander. Then the Coast Guard, it was a Coast Guard station down, which is now, well, I don't know what it is now, but it's building is down close to Browerville. Used to be a Coast Guard down there. It had a fence around it and so on. I think it's UIC headquarters, or it was UIC for a while.
Yeah, okay.
So they were, there was some Coast Guard people there. In fact, one of the guys from the Coast Guard was, took care of the radar for us for a while.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, the staff that was there, you mean the non-native staff who...
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, yeah, the director, like the biologists and the guys that ran it, you know, they had this big, the colony of...
The animal colony, right.
Yeah, that's where Craig George started.
Right, he did.
Yeah, his cousin of his worked up there, mm-hmm. too, for a long time. In fact, what's her name? Kate something or other. I think it was his girlfriend, not Craig, but Craig's cousin. She was mushing someplace or other and went on McKinley, but she did the radar for us for a while too. Mm. I mean, we said we had somebody up there who was hired to, you know, who we would pay just to go off and change the film every 3 days and that sort of thing.
Cool.
So that was the way we ran the radar.
Mm-hmm. And then you stayed in Quonset. They had
no. We stayed in the main Norrell building.
Oh, at that point, that was already.
It was like a hotel. I mean, there were rooms that, you know, rooms down there.
So you had your own rooms.
Well, there were two or three beds in a room, depending on who was there and whether you might have to share. And sometimes you might have it by yourself. Mm-hmm. So it just sort of varied.
Yeah.
That was before it was not the Norrell Hotel. Then. It was just the. I mean, it was just gnarled. And then after the Navy left, that's when Dario took over and started running it.
Like, right. But say you were staying in the main
building
versus in earlier periods, they were all living out in the Quonsets and that big building was built.
Yeah. I don't know where they stayed. There were a couple of other big Quonsets. Yeah. They had the building. The building was there when I got there.
Okay.
And it was pretty good. You know, these two wings down there and mm-hmm. Lots of beds in there. It was comfortable. It was a reasonable place.
Yeah, I kind of have this feeling in the, maybe it was the earlier time period than when you were there that, or maybe because people were there for a whole summer field season, that there was a lot of camaraderie and practical jokes and stuff, but that may not have been your experience.
No, because when we were there, like I say, it was during the winter. And there weren't that many people there. There'd people come in, like I say, to work on, mm-hmm. you know, the polar bear people used to come in and so on. They, you know, they were, you know, the state fish and wildlife was doing polar bears at that time.
Was that Jack Lenfer?
Yeah, Jack Lenfer. So he would come up there for a while and things like that. But they needed decent weather for it. So, mm-hmm. they were timed around that. There were people up there year round that were trying to do some things. It was not all that much, yeah. not that many of them.
Yeah, and so you never spent time on the ice islands then?
No, I never spent time there. No, that was just not what I was interested in doing. I was interested in mechanical properties and that stuff of looking at what was going on near mm-hmm. shore was just kind of a sideline to it because I was there and the radar was there.
Right. Well, I think maybe I would conclude with a couple of reflective looking back on your career kind of questions, and I know you're very humble and you don't think you've done anything important, but other people do.
All right, well, that's interesting.
So how do you respond? Like, what do you think you've contributed in terms of understanding of ice?
I don't know.
Or is there something you're particularly proud of in any of your projects?
No, not really, because I never... everything was a series of little steps. I guess. Mm-hmm. And that's about all. And I think of the steps. I don't think of any great overriding sort of things. I suppose that if somebody else thinks I did something, then maybe I did. Mm-hmm. But, you know. Well, actually, your contribution is mainly in the, you know, in the people, in the students, so to speak. And I never really have any CI students, except one guy. Because at the time I was doing this stuff, I always felt like I needed more support from a department of mechanics, and we just mm-hmm. didn't have it here. So I wasn't real keen on taking in students, because I wasn't interested in the chemistry so much as in the mechanic side of it. And so there was that, but I never felt like I had to support other places in the university. We just didn't have the departments here at the time to do it. In fact, they once asked me if I wanted to teach one of the courses, and I could never have done that. You know, I wasn't good enough to do that.
So you were a research faculty.
Well, no, at that time there was. I was actually, I was teaching stuff for geology. I taught prop mechanics and some structural geology, and then from 1982 till 1990. I think I taught all the structural geology.
Oh, okay. And did you have geology grad students then?
Okay. Yeah. One of them's with the State Oil and Gas Commission now. One of them was working with a Red Dog Mine. And he was unfortunately killed in an accident. Mm. One guy's in the oil industry down in Texas. Another guy's doing water resources stuff for the Forest Service and Stemware State of Washington. Woman working on research for a gas institute, I think it is, research in natural gas, but she went from here to Texas A&M and did a PhD. You know, so, I mean, you know, the people have sort of scattered that way.
Yeah, it's interesting that you didn't have any sea ice
graduates. My one sea ice graduate student was a guy from Japan, and he's still in sea ice.
Yeah, well, that's good.
He had a master's degree in Hokkaido. He came here and got another master's degree in geophysics and went back and did a PhD at Hokkaido.
Oh, cool.
And he's teaching now in northern Japan. Mm. So, yeah, I mean, you know, there's been a few. Mm-hmm. It's really hard to say. You know? Yeah. I mean, whatever influence you have is, you know, it's what people take away.
Yeah. Well, what's been the most fun for you about doing this work? Obviously, you've kept doing it.
Whew.
What's motivated you to keep doing it?
Oh, I don't know. Well, first of all, there wasn't any place else to go.
not continued to do sea ice. You could have gone back to...
Well, I taught it for a while, but I got to the point, you know, part of it was just the structure here. I mean, I was in the Geophysical Institute with the responsibility to raise funds and do research and things like that. Mm-hmm. And I could do it in sea ice, but I was teaching geology. Teaching in the geology department, and you know, it was hard to do. I was teaching, you know, two or three courses. I taught undergraduate structure. I taught two different graduate course structures in structural geology, and I taught field methods for a couple of years, and had graduate students down there, and did a couple of graduate seminars. So I was busy down there, but I couldn't keep doing that and do sea ice. You know, I couldn't raise money here, because the only place I could raise it really was through doing sea ice. Mm-hmm. And so at some point when there were people hired who could do my courses, and at that time the number of students started dropping off because it was just cyclic against the industry, you know, compared to what the industry does. At that point it was just easier. I mean, I had to do something, I had to go one way or the other. And the university offered a RIP. So. I had already gotten some work started up at Barrow with Willie and Richard Glenn when he'd come on as a graduate student. Had some things going on up there, and so I decided that I would just take that early retirement thing. So I did that in 1990. My last official working day was February 28th, 1990.
You still know, that's pretty amazing.
Oh yeah, well, it was a Friday night. Friday, February 28th, 1990, and 2 days later I was in Barrow. Working on the same project.
So that meant you didn't have to do the teaching.
Yeah,
you didn't have to do the fundraising, but you could still
do. I was doing a lot of. I did more fundraising after that.
So it meant you didn't have to teach. You could still do the research you wanted.
Yeah, well,
I
had to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and so I was able to do it. I was pretty successful at it afterwards. We had some good projects. Navy started a sea ice mechanics initiative, and we had some money in that. And then there was just a number of things that came along after that.
Yeah, there must have been something fun about...
Oh, yeah, well, you know, I always enjoyed doing it, you know, but... But I can't point to any one particular thing that I say was a real landmark, something that was really...
Well, or what you found most rewarding about doing this kind of work.
Oh, I don't know. Hard to say. I really can't think of anything in particular. It was just, I guess, just the general process of going. Mm-hmm. It's not so much a landmarks, it's just, you know, it's what life is, you know, it's just it's a process.
Mm-hmm. Well, are you glad you did all the sea ice, that you went into that?
Yeah, I am. It turned out to be good. I had a lot of interesting experiences. I got my one trip to Antarctica, which I never wanted to do, but I did it. Spent a year working with ARCO. Just instead of going on sabbatical, I went down to ARCO's, 1981, 82. They had an Arctic technology lab down in Texas, so we were down there for a year. Instead of going sabbatical, I went into the industry for a year. Then I did some consulting for them for a few years after that. We did got involved in some of the early, the drilling stuff in the Bering Sea. Mm. I was consulting for them on the ice problems, if you will. And it gave me good connection with the industry, and so I understood more about how the industry works and what they do. It was just an interesting learning experience.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting talking to you and coming to understand the real close connection between your research on sea ice dynamics and engineering.
Yeah, that's sort of what
I didn't realize that that's...
Yeah, that was really... That was the connection. In fact, that was one of the reasons I could talk to the people in the industry when I was doing this consulting work, because... that was what they were interested in at the time. Mm-hmm. Is this connection between the science, you know, the science learning the new stuff and the engineering part of it. Mm-hmm. That was a big thing. That was interesting to do.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, it was just a whole series of new things as you're going along. I mean, it's not, you know, not sitting in the lab, but going to new places or trying to do new things. We're trying to do new things in a different way, mm-hmm. I guess.
Well, we've sort of been talking a little bit before about how, you know, the ice conditions now are changing from maybe what they were when you were doing a lot of your work. What about the field of sea ice research in general, and how has that changed through your career, and how do you see that going into the future?
Well, first of all, equipment's much better now. People can, you know, you still got to go out and get your hands cold. I mean, that's a given. You're going to have to do that. But, you know, the science has moved along, that, and also there's better observational stuff now. You know, nobody was running submarines around under the ice when we were doing this stuff. I mean, the first ones were going on at that time, I think, upward-looking sonars. And now they're, you know, they're just all sorts of new equipment, new ways of handling things. There's a huge, huge data bank now observations of movement, of buoy movement. Not ice movement so much, but movement of buoys that are attached to the ice, that sort of thing. So there's a much more of a backlog of information that's around. There just wasn't that much. I mean, Willie used to say when he got into sea ice, the reason he got into it was, one of the reasons was there was no literature. You know? He didn't have to read so much. And it's true. I mean, he contributed a lot to the literature, but there wasn't a great literature because there wasn't a whole lot there. And that's one of the things that maybe I like to. Mm-hmm. It just wasn't a great deal.
Right. And now there is.
Now there's a lot. You can spend, you know, you can spend your time reading the literature.
So is there something that you think the sea ice researchers in the future should be looking at? There's something going on that hasn't been done?
Oh, well.
Or that you might not have time to get to in your lifetime.
Well, I don't know. I don't really know. I've started to think about some other kind of off-the-wall things, but I really don't want to talk about those things. I don't want to get into arguments with people on it. But, you know, there's some things are going to change, and some views are going to change, I think. I don't know. I just don't know. The big thing now, of course, is climate. And that's really what's motivating much of the work now, not all of it. The engineering stuff, I think, has kind of gone by the boards for the time being, simply because, for now, I think the oil industry, as far as they're concerned, they can pretty much handle most of what, I mean, they can overwhelm the ice. Mm-hmm. I mean, I always said, you know, from day one, you could say, if you were willing to spend enough money, you could build something that you could put any place out there and it would stand. It's just you can't afford to do it. So, you know, but I think that for the time being, I think things are okay. I don't, you know, Shell was drilling the Eastern Beaufort Sea, and that's, they've learned a lot about, and the Chukchi stuff too, and that would all be developed on the subsea, on mm-hmm. the seafloor. You wouldn't see anything on the surface. You wouldn't need anything. And the experience for that comes from the North Sea. They've been doing it there.
But the North Sea doesn't have the ice.
It doesn't have ice, but everything is, but they've developed this technology for doing things on the seafloor.
So the thing is, they'll do it, it won't matter what's happening with the ice, it's all underwater.
It's all going to be on the seafloor until you cross onto land. That's the only place you, right. That may be the only place you have a problem. See?
Yeah, because then you're in the near shore, very dynamic environment.
Yeah, it's a different environment, so you have to get across that. But the stuff in deeper water, they'll probably be down on the seafloor.
Interesting.
See? But on the other hand, you still have other, there's problems there, though. It's not like it's just that all that mm-hmm. easy.
Well, and you mentioned climate, that it certainly seems that climate drives a lot of the mm-hmm. issues and the viewpoint now. Mm-hmm. But when you were in the 70s starting, that wasn't something anybody thought about.
No. So, at that time, I mean, not for me anyway. Somebody may have been thinking about it. Somebody probably was. And the meteorologists were certainly thinking mm-hmm. about it. Because, I mean, not so much from a climate point of view, but just from wind-ice interactions.
Right.
And currents, and there's still a lot of work that could be done on subsea currents and the way currents affect the ice motion mm-hmm. and so on. There are things like that. I mean, there are good research fields still available.
Mm-hmm. Well, so when you started, instead of climate, it was this engineering.
Just understanding the environment because you were trying to do things.
Right. Okay.
That's a good way to.
That's
at least that was my view of it. It was trying to understand it because there were things to be done.
Right.
Krell was always, even the guys at Krell that were doing the science were also very practical. I mean, they had real science, you know, real engineering problems that they were trying to do.
Well, and you mentioned current. From my experience of living in Barrow and talking with the Inupiat people, wind and current and understanding mm-hmm. ice behavior in those contexts, seems that's what they really know a lot about.
Yeah, and for good reason.
Right, but that's not what you were working on, so you didn't talk to them so much.
No, not so much about that. I mean, basically the idea was, you know, what drives ice up on the beach?
Right.
And, you know, there's a role for water in it, not necessarily the current, but, you know, water level. Weather systems changing, the sea level and so on, that sort of thing.
So wind and current doesn't affect those push-ups?
Oh, yeah, wind does.
But current doesn't.
Well, I don't know. Hmm. You know what he's ever measuring currents. They don't. You know, you don't measure currents that close in because you can't leave a meter there very long. You mm-hmm. can go out and do spot things, but you can't leave a current meter there.
But so those ice push-ups were influenced by the water height?
I think the water level has something to do with it.
And the wind, too?
And wind drive. Something's got to drive it, but it may not be the local wind. I mean, basically, a friend of mine, Bob Pritchard, used to always say, you know, what moves ice? Well, the reason the piece of ice moves is because the piece of ice next to it moves. So, you know, everything sort of pushes along. So you can be pushing ice from a long distance away. Just, you know, a weather system somewhere is tightening the pack up, and eventually it comes piling up on the beach. But it may have started, you know, a couple hundred miles away or something, more than that.
Yeah. Well, and I also found it interesting that, you know, what happens with the ice off of Barrow is affected by different winds and things than if you're in Point Hope or if you're in Koktovik or something, the geography and the winds are different.
The winds and the orientation of the coast relative to the wind directions mm-hmm. and so on. So the environments are all different, they're local environments.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. I don't know if there's anything else I haven't asked you that you want to talk about, but
I don't know. I better get over. And
I know
see.
You have a lunch.
I gotta go see Josie. No, I was just going to stop.
Oh, her. Okay.
She's from Ghana.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me turn this off. Yeah. Thank you, Lou.
Yeah.